Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The Court has invited briefing in the additional question presented on the application of AEDPA in this case. And in light of the Court's many questions this morning, I want to address that. But I did want to clear up one piece of information that seems to be confusing in the record, and if I can start with that. And this was in response, I think, to a question you asked, Justice Ginsburg, regarding the prejudice prong of the Strickland claim. And the question was, why is it harmless? And counsel suggested that there was an absence of blood between the blood pool and the couch. And Detective Bell testified to that. And I just want to clear up, because I know this bit was confusing in the briefs, too. That is not what Detective Bell testified to. If you look at pages 181 and 195 of the reporter's transcript in Exhibit R5, you'll see that Detective Bell says, yes, there were drops leading away from the couch. Yes, there were drops leading away from the blood pool. And, in fact, Exhibit R5 is a picture of the couch, and you can indeed see.
I thought that the point was that there was no trail from the bed. I mean, the theory was that Klein was removed from the bed to the couch. And I thought that the point that counsel for the State emphasized was that if someone were moved from the bed, taken to the living room couch, you would have expected to see a trail of blood from the bed, and there wasn't that.
Indeed. But the State's theory, the defense theory was that the body had been moved from the blood pool, not the bed, the blood pool to the couch. And the State's response in its briefing and today at oral argument was that there was no blood trail between the blood pool and the couch. And indeed, that's not what Detective Bell testified to. He said there were drops outside the blood pool, drops outside the couch, and when asked if there was blood in the carpeting in between, he said he did not remember how much blood there was in between.
So the idea is that Johnson drags Klein. This is your theory, right? Because you're not suggesting he could have lifted Klein and walked him over, are you?
Yes, I think he could have lifted him, Your Honor.
Really? Did you have an expert testify to that?
No.
Did you get expert testimony about that or an expert report about that?
No, there was no expert testimony about the ability of someone to lift the weight.
But you think you can assume that he could lift the weight. How much did Klein weigh?
I think he weighed between 150 and 160 pounds.
And Johnson?
I think about the same, Your Honor.
Okay. And you say that he could have dragged him from the pool to the couch because there were drops.
I'm saying that the testimony and the suggestion that there was no trail of blood between the blood pool and the couch is not consistent with what Detective Bell testified.
And what's your theory about why Johnson would have a motive to go through this exertion? He's wounded, and let's say there really was a gunfight, and Klein fell someplace else. Johnson wants to make it seem like Klein was that there wasn't any gunfight. Why is it so valuable to him to move Klein's body from the location where you think he fell to the couch?
Well, if he falls in the bedroom doorway, Your Honor, and he falls in a crossfire, then Johnson is in some ways culpable. Now, we don't know what the extent of his culpability is, but if he's involved in firing the first shot, he is culpable. Putting Klein on the couch and having a State's theory that Klein is shot in cold blood on the couch eliminates his culpability, or at least eliminates the risk of it.
But he could have, if he's going to make up a story, he could have made up the story that Klein jumped up and he was shot without having engaged in any firing himself, and he fell wherever he fell. Putting him on the couch doesn't seem to, unless I'm missing something, I wish you'd explain it, doesn't seem to aid this purportedly false story very much. And if you weigh whatever benefit there is from that against the exertion of moving this guy, doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. But maybe there's something there that's not apparent.
Well, I can only say that if Klein is caught in a crossfire, then Johnson is culpable. And let's remember, he has drugs in the house. He has scales. He has all sorts of drugs.
Why wouldn't he wipe up the blood? I mean, what good is it to simply put him on the couch when you leave the pool of blood? Well, showing that that's where he was shot.
Yes, I don't doubt that in retrospect he could have come up with a better plan, Your Honor. But I do think it's important to realize that this plan, at least on its face and initially in terms of his adrenaline response, is going to get him out of a crossfire scenario.
Counsel, there's a lot of talk about the importance of this pool of blood. But as I read Detective Bell's testimony, he never posited or talks about how that pool was formed. Only your expert does that. What Bell does talk about, however, is that there's a high-velocity blood splatter in front of the couch, and that the pooling of blood on Klein's face shows that he was shot there. Your experts do nothing to refute that testimony, which was really the basis of Bell's testimony. He had nothing to say about the pool of blood. He talked about why Klein was shot where he was shot, and there's no expert testimony to refute that. So how do you get past there being a reasonable probability of a different verdict when there is nothing to refute the critical testimony at issue that Klein was shot where he was shot because there's high-velocity blood splatter in front of him and because the pooling on his face shows that?
Let's take both the high-velocity blood splatter and the pooling, Your Honor, but let me start with the predicate, and you are right. Detective Bell did not testify at all about the formation of the blood pool, and that's why this case isn't about anticipating a state's expert about the blood pool, but about getting your own for your own case. But turning to the specifics of your question, the high-velocity blood spatter, it actually wasn't in front of the couch, Your Honor. It was to the side and below the arm. And let's remember Detective Bell's testimony about how the homicide occurred, because the state's theory was not that Pat Klein was shot while he was lying on the couch, but that he was sitting on the couch. And so what's most interesting about the high-velocity blood spatter, since he's shot in the head, is that there is none on the wall immediately behind the couch. This was a matter of some confusion in the briefs as well, but I think it's been cleared up. There's no high-velocity blood spatter behind on the pristine white wall. So the question is, if he's shot while sitting up, the high-velocity blood spatter that Bell testifies to travels over about 4 feet over the couch, and then two drops sink down. Now, in terms of the jury evaluating that testimony, it's important to note that Detective Bell gave a description of what high-velocity blood spatter is, and he said it's a fan-like pattern of atomized blood. And when you look at these two drops alone that travel 4 feet and then drop straight down to fall on a plastic bag, you see, as defense counsel pointed out in his closing argument, that they are the same size as blood drops found in the kitchen on exhibits R18 through R22. And Detective Bell's entire theory for why these were high velocity was their size. There was never any dispute that there was no shooting in the kitchen.
Counsel, what other expert evidence should Richter's counsel have pursued before deciding upon his course of action in this case? Put aside the blood spatter expert. What other experts did he need to consult?
Well, putting aside the blood spatter issue, and these were raised in the lower court but not addressed, there were he's promised the jury ballistics testimony as well, which he didn't produce.
Okay, we got a blood spatter expert, a ballistics expert. Go on. I thought in their habeas proceeding you said he should consult a serologist and a pathologist. Okay, that's four. Why wouldn't he want to talk to an expert on the effects of alcohol and drugs on the people's different perceptions of the events?
Well, I think the chief reason is that wasn't part of his theory. If you look, and really the guide to this, Your Honor, is defense counsel's own theory. Because defense counsel stands up in opening statement and he promises the jury a theory. And the theory isn't you're going to hear two stories and you have to assess credibility. His theory, as he explained to the jury, was the physical evidence will show you Pat Klein was not shot on the couch.
Well, he had not received a notice from the state that they were going to call any experts. So why wasn't it reasonable for him to assume they're not going to call any experts, they're not going to be able to pull experts out of their pocket in the midst of the trial, and the judge isn't going to allow them to do that without providing without granting a recess? What seems to have happened here seems pretty unusual.
Well, if this case were about anticipating the state's decision to call an expert, I would agree, but it's not. And the reason it's not is because we have an insight into what defense counsel's theory of the case was before the state ever started its case, Your Honor.
The Ninth Circuit said that part of the ineffective assistance was failing to consult an expert in planning his defense and in preparing his defense, not simply responding to the state's expert in the middle of trial.
I agree, Your Honor. And if I said something that sounded like I didn't, then I misspoke. My point is that's exactly the theory. Once defense counsel decides on this defense, in this case, I think he picked the right defense. He told the jury the physical evidence would prove Pat Klein wasn't on the couch, and he could have done that. But despite promising the jury that the physical evidence would prove this, he never consulted with someone.
And once — Can you explain the blood pooling in the face for me? You talk about the high velocity.
Yes, I did, and I didn't get back to it. Thank you, Your Honor. The testimony was, of course, about the blood pattern flow on the face. And when you read Detective Bell's testimony carefully, that testimony has nothing to do with where Pat Klein is shot. It has to do with the angle of his face after he's shot. So if he's shot on the bedroom in the bedroom doorway and falls, and that's the angle, the blood flow would be the same. So it really, the blood flow pattern really has little to do with where he's shot, but just the angle of his face. And getting back to the blood spatter itself, the blood pool itself, what's interesting is this case, in this case now, is that even after all these years, the state has never disputed the fact that the absence of satellite drops means the state's theory is false. Gunnar Johnson could not have deposited that blood because there's no satellite drops, which means it had to come from another source. The only other source is Pat Klein.
Did I understand you? I just want to step back to the prior answer. You think what counsel did here would have been effective assistance, but for exactly what he said in the opening statement?
If the question is, but for the opening statement, would we still have this argument? Yes, although it would be much more difficult to establish what his theory was. The opening statement doesn't change the Strickland analysis. It simply gives us an insight, an easier path into knowing what counsel's theory was. Much like the case of Wiggins versus Smith, where the court looked at defense counsel's opening statement in the penalty phase repeatedly to see what was his theory and what didn't he do. And when there was a suggestion made in Wiggins versus Smith that, in fact, counsel's theory was something else, the court said, no, look at his opening statement. We know what his theory was. So it doesn't change the standard, but it gives us a very keen insight into exactly what he was thinking and when he was thinking it.
Mr. Gardner, what about the argument that all of this is beside the point, because the argument for prejudice is so weak, given all the other evidence that Mr. Colombo referred to?
Well, it will come as no surprise to know that I disagree with that argument, Your Honor, and for a couple of reasons. The cases really came down to Gunnar Johnson versus Petitioner Richter. Who was the jury going to believe? Even on the record that counsel has described, the jury deliberated 14 hours. And remember, that record included a surviving eyewitness. And if you believe the surviving eyewitness, the case is over. The jury deliberated over 14 hours, asking for re-instruction twice and a rereading of testimony three times. And I think there's good reason for that.
Well, of course, Johnson had given so many inconsistent statements at the outset that he was a weak prosecution witness. It seems to me the defense could have pinned a great deal of hope on that.
Well, I think actually I agree with the predicate of the question, Your Honor, and that is Johnson had given a number of stories. He'd given four or five different stories. And after all, he knew both Branscombe and Richter. When he first spoke to the 911 people, they said, what happened? He said, five people came in and shot me. Then he said four. Then he said three. And when they said who, he said, I don't know. So clearly, Gunnar Johnson was a compromised witness, Your Honor. But the fact that the state has a compromised witness is not the reason not to research the physical evidence and enhance your client's credibility. It's more of a reason to do it.
But what do you do with the ammunition back at Richter's home, that the gun safe is found there, the unlikely story about them having the zeal to clean up their workplace and then coming back?
Well, let me take them one at a time, Your Honor. And in a sense, the ammo and the gun safe, the answer is very similar. All parties agreed in this case that several weeks before the incident, Gunnar Johnson had stored all his belongings at my client's house. And so the only dispute was had the gun safe included. And this is one of the unusual features, is that the state's theory requires us to believe that this happened so he could rob a gun safe that had been at his house for weeks. The question was, had the material, the gun safe and the ammo, whose was it, and had it been taken back to Gunner's house? The ammo is found in a place with two other things. It's found with a scale used for measuring drugs, and it's found with shotgun ammunition. Now, the record shows that Gunnar Johnson had a shotgun, and Gunnar Johnson was a drug dealer. So the defense theory, of course, is that this ammo wasn't my client's. It was Gunnar Johnson's and hadn't been moved back. Similarly, as to the safe, there was conflicting testimony as to whether the safe had ever been moved back. So that really is the explanation, and that, I think, is why the jury had such pause about this case when it heard the case.
The case against Gunner you've just described, would it have been enough, and wouldn't that have justified counsel's decision to focus on credibility rather than expert physical evidence?
I think not, and we know this again for two reasons. And let me start by saying the fact is that when counsel was asked, that wasn't the reason he gave. It's not as if he came to the depo and he said, this was my tactical reason, and so we can say, okay, that's a reasonable tactical decision. That wasn't the decision reason he gave. When asked, did you decide not to present, or why didn't you present this blood spatter testimony, he said, I simply didn't know it was out there. And after all, let's keep in mind this was only his second trial, his second murder trial. He didn't know it was out there. So he didn't make that tactical decision, and that's the first reason. The second reason, I think, is that and almost every case that has ever addressed this, and I've cited most of them, has come to the same conclusion. When there is a credibility determination, when any defense lawyer worth his salt knows that there's a credibility determination to be made, the jury is going to believe either this story or my client's story, it at least behooves you to investigate to see if the physical evidence can support your position. You can always
The counsel have to investigate the other aspects? I mean, we're focusing on the scene where the shooting took place. Did he have to consider experts with respect to the bypass where they threw the guns, Richter's apartment, the vehicle that was used? One thing counsel said is he thought about hiring a tire expert because of the vehicle. He has to look at the possibility of expert testimony affecting every aspect of the various scenes that were pertinent in this crime?
I don't believe so. And the reason, again, comes back to the same focus this Court had in Wiggins, another failure to investigate case. What we know is that counsel suggested to the told the jury in opening statement, this is about the physical evidence will show this. When it's clear that that's counsel's position in a case, it's simply application of the Strickland test. It's unreasonable for counsel not to at least have investigated the physical evidence that he told the jury would show that Klein wasn't on the couch.
What happens? I know you have an answer that that's not this case, but what happens if the defendant tells his lawyer, look, I did it, I'm guilty, and the lawyer decides that the best thing to do is try to pin it on a guy whose nickname is Gunner? What else is the lawyer supposed to do? He thinks no matter what physical evidence is found, it's got to cut against his client because his client did it.
Well, in a situation where counsel's investigation will not be exposed to the prosecutor, and there were questions before about how California procedure works, and indeed, once you decide to name to call a witness, you name him, and he becomes exposed for cross-examination and for investigation. But at least in terms of your private investigation of a case, the ABA standards are fairly clear that even an admission of guilt doesn't affect your ability or your obligation to investigate.
But if the expert says that the pool of blood all belonged to, I guess it's Johnson, I certainly think ethically that you could not argue otherwise to the jury.
I think ethically you couldn't argue otherwise to the jury.
All right, so that's a reason why defense counsel, in the case the Chief Justice puts in many cases, prefers not to have experts just so they can punch holes in the state's case. That's a legitimate strategy. And this counsel was very an adept cross-examiner. There's no doubt about that.
I don't disagree, except that, again, we come back to the notion from Wiggins, which is you can't defend a tactical judgment that wasn't made. And, in fact, when counsel was asked, is this the reason you did this, he said, no, I didn't call a blood spatter expert because I didn't know it was out there.
Can I come back to your response to the Chief Justice's question about counsel who knows that his client is guilty? And you say the ABA standards say that even when that's the case, you have an obligation to get an expert witness to confirm that the client is —
I'm sorry. I thought the hypothetical was counsel's client has said he was guilty, not that counsel knew he was guilty.
Right.
The ABA standards say that the duty to investigate, the broad duty to investigate on defense counsel exists irrespective of the client's statements to his lawyer.
We've never adopted the ABA standards.
In that regard, no.
Standard seems to me quite silly.
I can understand that, Your Honor, but from practical experience, I will tell you the fact that a client admits to something doesn't mean he did it or she did it. That's the real-world consequence we face as defense lawyers. Often our clients tell us things, and you can't always believe them, whether they say they're innocent or whether they say they're guilty.
Oh, well, I'm sure they often say they're innocent when they're guilty. I'm astounded that they often say they're guilty when they're innocent.
Well, you know, I'd suggest, Your Honor, the false confession literature that's come out, and there's plenty of it to show that, in fact, that's not an infrequent occurrence.
Oh, to the police, perhaps, yes, but to his own counsel? I'm not aware of any literature to that effect.
In which case, I'll come back to the answer the Chief Justice suggested moments ago, that that's not my case. It seems like a safe haven at this point.
Also, your case does involve the AEDPA issue. Perhaps
it does.
You want to
that's
turn to
I,
that now.
I was trying to use that as a segue into that, Your Honor. Thank you.
It worked.
It worked. That rarely happens, Your Honor. And let me turn then to the AEDPA issues in this case. Because on March 28, 2001, this California Supreme Court denied the petition for writ of habeas corpus in my client's case with an order that said the petition for writ of habeas corpus is denied. That same day, in five other cases, non-capital cases, the California Supreme Court denied the writ saying the petition for writ of habeas corpus is denied on the merits. And the State's position here today and in the briefing is that the federal courts should simply ignore that difference. And I don't believe that's the case for several reasons.
What is your answer to the representation that Henry Robbins settled, that when the court, California Supreme Court, says just denied, it's on the merits?
Well, I agree and I disagree. Henry Robbins does settle the matter from a state law perspective, but not as the Attorney General has suggested. Henry Robbins says a few things. First, it says that when we deny a case on the merits, we add the phrase on the merits. Then it says that when we find a procedural default, we cite to that default so that everyone knows. And then it says, and this was in response, I think, to a question you asked, Justice Scalia, they say a third thing. They say sometimes we'll find both, that it's meritless and it's defaulted, and we will say both. We will cite a default and we will say it's denied on the merits as well, trusting that the federal courts will give deference.
What they cite it for, actually, is they make a slightly different argument in their brief. They say, going back to 1974, there are at least three cases in the Ninth Circuit that have said when the California Supreme Court says nothing, just denied, we take that as a decision to reach the federal issue and deny it on the merits. Now, not in your case, but in most cases, that will benefit a defendant because it will avoid the question of whether there's an adequate and independent state ground of a procedural nature. So what they're saying is that that's the Ninth Circuit statement in three cases, and the California Supreme Court, over a course of 30 years, has never said to the contrary, which it had plenty of opportunity to do, and in other instances where the Ninth Circuit was wrong, it did do it. So that I think, is a fairly strong argument. Now, the only reason that you're not out of court on your own interpretation is because you'll say that the state waived the procedural issue. And then they'll come back and say, so did you. So what is your response to all that?
Well, there's a whole bunch there, so let me see if I can tease it out. It is true that the Ninth Circuit has had this process, this procedure, for a long time. And, of course, it developed in a pre-AEDPA world when the fact that whether something was on the merits or not didn't really matter. The only question was it defaulted? And if it was defaulted, it might bar federal review. Whether it was on the merits was really irrelevant because before 2254D, that really didn't matter. So that's where, and I agree with the State, that's where those cases come from. I don't believe, however, that the waiver argument is really implicated here, Your Honor.
Well, look, for example, in Hunter v. I. Spuro, they quote it as saying the following: the California Supreme Court's denial of a state habeas petition, quote, without comment or citation, constitutes a decision on the merits of the federal claims, end quote. And then they have three other cases roughly to the same effect. Now, what you're saying is that this court should hold to the contrary, and by the way, in doing that, we will bar many federal habeas petitioners from the federal courts, because what it will mean is that there is an adequate and independent state ground in case after case, which perhaps is an irrelevant feature. But nonetheless, the silence of the California Supreme Court is significant, I think, when faced with those pretty clear interpretations of what their silence means by the Ninth Circuit.
Yes. And actually, if the Ninth Circuit were the only voice in the fray, Your Honor, I think the argument would be stronger. But the Ninth Circuit's voice isn't the only voice in the fray, and that brings me to Yilst. In Yilst, of course, and Yilst versus Nunnemaker is a case which is part and parcel of this history from the Ninth Circuit of saying silent denial is on the merits. In Yilst versus Nunnemaker, that's exactly what the Ninth Circuit said. And it came to this Court, and the State actually argued that it wasn't on the merits. And indeed, this Court held that you cannot tell from a silent denial whether it's on the merits or not. That's the first response, Your Honor, is that there are additional voices other than the Ninth Circuit. The second is that well after Hunter versus Asparo comes the Robbins footnote. And in the Robbins
footnote, I'm having a very hard time with your reliance on that footnote, because the very last paragraph of that footnote says, when respondents assert, and I'm shortening the introductory line, a state procedural bar, and when nevertheless our order disposing of a habeas corpus petition does not impose the proposed bar or bars as to that claim, that signifies that we have considered respondent's assertion and have determined that the claim or subclaim is not barred on the procedural ground.
Yes.
So the footnote itself says, unless we invoke the procedural bar, we're not applying it.
I think that's right, Your Honor, but that's not the only thing the footnote says. The footnote says, when we deny on the merits, we say on the merits. When we cite a procedural bar, we mean the bar. And if the State has raised a bar, as they did here, and we don't rely on it, that means we haven't relied on the procedural bar.
Right.
When you put those together, what it means is there was no majority for a decision on the merits, otherwise they would have said on the merits. There was no majority for a decision on procedural default, otherwise they would have said default. And that's what a silent denial means, and that's exactly what this Court said in Yilst. You cannot tell because there are seven judges, there are different claims, there are different possibilities. That's why a silent denial is there in state court. It's for precisely.
Excuse me, there's no majority for either ground, and yet you find in favor of the state? How can that be?
Well, you say either ground. There are multiple grounds for procedural default, Your Honor, under state law. There are many possible procedural defaults.
Yeah, but you're positing that the only time they do not say either procedurally barred or on the merits is when they don't have a majority for either one.
That's correct.
How can they render a decision in favor of the state, then, if there's no majority for either disposition?
The question is why deliberate to a majority when they sit around the conference, the seven judges, let's say two judges believe there's a procedural default of untimeliness. Two judges think it's timely, but think it should have been raised below. Two judges think it's both timely and it didn't need to be raised below, but it hasn't been pled with sufficient specificity, and one judge thinks it's improper on the merits. There's seven judges. They all believe it should be denied, but there's no majority for any position. There's no reason for the California Supreme Court, and this is addressed more in the amicus brief by the California Academy of Appellate Lawyers, there's no reason for the California Supreme Court at that point to spend a day, 2 days debating it when all seven judges agree there's a reason to deny it.
Under your example, isn't there a majority for the proposition that there's a procedural default, a disagreement as to the particular procedural default?
That could be. And what the California...
If it's just a binary choice between procedural default and merits, isn't there going to be, and everybody agrees it should be denied, then there's going to be a majority for one or the other, right?
That is true, and then I have been unclear, and I apologize for that. It is not a binary choice between default and merits. It's a choice between which default and merits. And there are many defaults under state law. When the court denies on timeliness grounds, it will cite Clark. When the court finds that it's been pled with insufficient specificity, it will cite Swain.
Well, is there more than one possible procedural problem here?
Yes.
But it was just timeliness.
Well, timeliness was the only one raised by the state, but to be sure, like this court, the California Supreme Court has never been bound in terms of its procedural default findings by what's been raised. And
what others could apply in this case?
Well, at the risk of not wanting to argue against my client, I can give you some that could apply that haven't been suggested and therefore are most certainly waived. But the California law often requires that you file your habeas petition in a lower court first. Reviewing courts often deny petitions for failure to file in a lower court first. There's a requirement that says you must plead with sufficient specificity. That's often relied on by reviewing courts. There's a requirement that says you must attach all readily available documents. That's another.
With this confusion, your version, your colleague's version, when the district court denied relief, Did you ask the district court, please certify this question of what a silent denial means, certify it to the California Supreme Court so we will have once and for all an answer of what a silent denial means?
The answer is no, I didn't request certification. When we were in district court and when we were in the Ninth Circuit, both sides accepted the existing framework the Ninth Circuit had established. It applies to a silent denial, but only through the lens of independent review. The Court's added question has put both of those at issue.
Thank you, counsel.